Our next panel is going to be on emotion and motivation. It's going to be led by Maurizio Fava, Executive Vice Chair of the MGH Department of Psychiatry at Mass General. I need to put in a plug for Mass General. When we first had the idea of One Mind, we met with Maurizio and Jerry Rosenbaum, and they were enthusiastic and immediate supporters of the idea. And we were very pleased to have their commitment to actually host the conference at their location. And unfortunately, our success got in the way and we outgrew the facility, but their commitment was an actual, very much an integral part, and we thank them. Jerry's here, and Gary Gottlieb, who's not here but will be here tomorrow, was enthusiastic supporters, and we couldn't be here without you. So, Maurizio, I'll invite you to come up with your panel and get us started.
Thank you very much, Karen. I'd like to really thank Karen Stagley and Patrick Kennedy and Steve Hyman and everyone involved in this wonderful event. You've seen the data from Mark McClellan and from Steve Hyman about how prevalent, how common neuropsychiatric disorders are. And we can say that almost every family in America has been affected or will be affected by neuropsychiatric diseases. Having lost recently my mother to complications from Parkinson's disease, I can certainly attest to that. The tremendous burden that the neuropsychiatric diseases place on our society are accompanied by costs that far exceed the cost to society that cancer or heart disease have. But I want to kind of shift a little bit the issue about cost and impact to a slightly different population, our youngsters. Many neuropsychiatric diseases, like depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, autism, they strike our youngsters. And in fact, if you look at the data, the same WHO data that Steve Hyman showed you yesterday, neuropsychiatric disorders, such as the one I just mentioned, represent the main source of disability in young adults. Our symposium will have an advocate, Linnea Johnson, who's a brilliant and very talented writer who has just published a book, Perfect Chaos, who's going to tell us about that burden from the perspective of someone who has actually suffered from bipolar disorder, as a kind of a in the struck as a young person. As a practicing clinician, I also feel like I have to comment about treatments. You know, should we be satisfied with the treatments that we have? Well, if we look at schizophrenia, for example, we have drugs that do treat symptoms like hallucinations and delusions, but do very little for cognitive symptoms like executive function difficulties or memory problems or attention problems. And they do very little for symptoms such as social withdrawal or diminished motivation. In autism, we have drug treatments that are typically supportive and symptomatic, but don't address the core symptoms of this condition. The same thing is true for PTSD. In depression, we have antidepressants. We have many antidepressants, but as we've shown in STAR-D, only about a third of the people who are treated adequately with antidepressants will actually get into remission. And even when antidepressants work, they take weeks, if not months, to work. So in that context, our second, one of our panelists, Helen Mayberg, is going to talk about something very exciting that may hopefully bring a very rapid resolution to depression through deep brain stimulation. Another challenge that we face in practice is the challenge of diagnosis. Steve Hyman actually has recently articulated a dilemma at Grand Rounds and Mass General. you know, we our best diagnostic classification, the one that we use, the DSM-IV classification, is clearly inadequate. Doesn't really incorporate kind of breakthroughs or recent discoveries in neuroscience from the genetics, molecular standpoint. So an exciting new initiative from the National Institute of Mental Health called the Research Domain Criteria, or RDoC project, focuses on the study of dimensions that may be relevant to neuropsychiatric diseases. Focuses on things like social systems and attachment and fear and reward and so two of our presenters are going to focus on some of these two dimensions. Larry Young is going to talk about attachment and social neuroscience and implications for new treatments for conditions that are affected by changes in social cognition like autism and schizophrenia. And Eric Nestler is going to talk about the importance of the reward system in conditions of the neuroscience of reward systems in addiction and depression. So we're going to start our session with Larry Young, who's the William Timmy Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences and Director of the Center for Translational Neuroscience at Emory University. Please welcome Dr. Larry Young.
Okay, thank you, Mauricio, for that introduction. And I want to thank Congressman Kennedy and Steve Hyman and the other organizers for inviting me to participate in this absolutely fantastic symposium. It's really an honor for me to be here. And I'm particularly excited that the organizers recognize social neuroscience as an important area of future research. I am very excited about the progress that's being made in that area right now. I think it's a frontier in neuroscience. So we all know the importance of social relationships. When social relationships are disrupted, it can cause an increase in risk of mental health, depression, but also cardiovascular function, immune function, so even increasing mortality. So social relationships are very important to our health. And we also know that there are certain psychiatric disorders where the ability to form social relationships or to interact with others in a normal way is disrupted, such as in autism and also maybe in schizophrenia. And so social neuroscience is moving forward in understanding how the brain works to create those social relationships and interrelate with each other. And one important area of investigation has been using functional magnetic resonance imaging to understand brain activations during while people conduct social relevant tasks, including things like cooperation or making moral decisions. And we're beginning to understand the neural circuitry behind the social brain. We're actually able to now interact multiple individuals at the same time to sort of look at the interacting mind, the interacting social brain, which I think is very exciting. That's one big area of social neuroscience, but I want to focus on another area where instead of identifying the brain regions that are activated during certain processes, we can actually identify the molecules and the genes and the individual circuits that are involved in these kinds of social relationships. And we can only do this using animal models. And I'm just going to show you one particular animal model that's been particularly fruitful for understanding social relationships. And these are called prairie voles. These are different from rats and mice in the sense that these guys are highly social. Not only are they highly social and crave social contact, but these guys form social relationships that last a lifetime. So they form bonds between the partners. Only about 3% of mammals do that. Humans do that. Humans form these long-term bonds. Prairie voles do that. So they provide us an opportunity to look into the mechanisms that are involved in those forming those social relationships. And I just want to highlight, well, first of all, so I just wanted to give you an idea. How do we study social bond formation in an animal? We use this test called a partner preference test. It's simply we put the animals together. put a male and a female together, and usually mating solidifies this bond between the two. But if we prevent mating, we can go into the brain and manipulate various neurochemicals, and manipulate brain areas, manipulate gene expression, and identify the mechanisms that are involved in producing that bond. After this cohabitation period, we can put them together in this partner preference test and simply ask. Here we're going to ask, who does the female prefer to spend her time with, her male partner or a stranger? And through quantifying the relationship, who they spend their time with, we can identify whether they've formed a bond or not. So that's just how we do the behavioral test. And I want to introduce one molecule. We've studied many molecules. I just want to introduce one that plays a particularly important role in social neuroscience, and that is oxytocin. Oxytocin is a molecule that's produced in the brain, and it's really critical for birth and reproduction. It's involved in uterus contractions during initiation of labor. Physicians use it to induce labor. After the baby's born, during nursing, oxytocin is released to cause milk ejection so that the baby can nurse and get milk. But importantly, we know from studies in animals that not only does oxytocin coordinate the peripheral physiology of reproduction, but it also tunes the mother's brain to attention to the baby so that she becomes bonded to that baby. She is motivated to interact with that baby. And rat studies, for example, oxytocin can stimulate maternal behavior such that the female will cross an electrified grid to get access to her pup. So it's a really strong involvement in social bonding. Well, in prairie voles, we know that it's also involved in the formation of relationships between the pair. If you take a female prairie vole, for example, she's not mated, but before you put her in the cage with a male, you just infuse her brain with a little bit of oxytocin, place her in that cage. If she interacts with that male while her brain is being bathed by that oxytocin, and we test her on that partner preference test, she will have bonded with that male. So oxytocin can stimulate the formation of social attachments in these animals. Now, one of the cool things about studying animals, especially these voles, is that they're different kinds of voles with different kinds of behaviors. Although they look very similar, they're very different. So I told you about the prairie voles, which are highly social. We also have meadow voles, which are virtually asocial. They do not crave social contact. So we can compare the differences between voles that are highly social and form bonds and ones who cannot form these kinds of a social attachment. And since we're focusing here on the oxytocin system, I'll show you some of the differences there. If we look in the brain to see what parts of the brain can respond to oxytocin by looking at the receptors, we see that there are really remarkable differences in the location of receptors in the brain. So this is an area called the nucleus accumbens. It's involved in reward and reinforcement. We'll hear about it's also involved in addiction from Eric Nestler's talk. Prairie voles, the ones that can form these bonds, have high densities of receptors there. The ones who cannot have very low densities of receptors there. And we know that those receptors are absolutely critical for pair bond, because if we block those and not others, it will prevent the female from being able to form a bond when she's with her male. So we, through studies like this, we're actually able to develop an idea of the neural circuitry that's underlying social attachment, the relationship between two individuals. I've just told you about oxytocin. We know that other molecules, dopamine, which is also involved in addiction, is also involved in partner preference, the pair bonding, and vasopressin. Now imagine that if we understand the circuitry, that we may be able to harness that to try to and maybe enhance social attachment, social cognitive function. Now, I want to now just talk a little bit about how the work that we have been doing in voles has been translated into human studies to show you that actually the same kinds of mechanisms that are involved in vole social attachment, this pair bonding, are involved in human interpersonal relationships. There have been dozens of studies now giving people oxytocin through intranasal administration. It's not very efficient at getting into the brain, but it can penetrate the brain, apparently, and has interesting effects. For example, in typical adults, if intranasal oxytocin increases the amount of time spent gazing into another person's eyes. Possibly as a consequence of that, it helps increases the ability to infer the emotions of other people. It tunes in the mind to the other people. Now, we know in voles and in rodents that one of the things that oxytocin is doing is tuning the attention of the animal to the other animal in a social interaction, and it seems to be doing a very similar thing in humans. And this is just a list of some of the things that intranasal oxytocin has been shown to do. It increased trust in others. Eye gaze, mind reading, which is inferring the emotions of others. increases the memory of faces, even increases empathy. And I think more importantly for psychiatric disorders, it enhances socially reinforced learning. So if the reinforcer is a social stimulus, individuals are able to learn tasks better with that if they're taking oxytocin. So again, what we think oxytocin is doing here is increasing the saliency of social stimuli so that the individual pays much more attention to the social stimulus. Now, I want to turn to what this might mean for psychiatric disorders. So as you all know, autism spectrum disorder is a collection of disorders where one of the cardinal features is a disruption in social reciprocity and social relationships, social motivation. Schizophrenia also has elements of social disruption. Now, one of the challenges for developing drugs to treat these disorders, especially this diagram here is particular for autism, is that autism spectrum disorder is a collection of disorders of heterogeneous nature. Many genes have been found to be involved. There's some sort of environmental component. So although we can learn clues by identifying those individual genes of maybe what's going wrong, maybe in order to treat the disorder, we have to think at a different level. And maybe that way is to think about how we can enhance social cognitive function through a common mechanism. So autism and schizophrenia are not the only psychiatric disorders that involve social disruptions. Many psychiatric disorders involve social disruptions, so I think it's imperative that we understand the biology of social cognition. Now I want to talk a little bit about some actual applications in autism. There's been a few studies in the last couple of years that have taken the lead from the animal research in the voles and then the intranasal oxytocin studies in typical adults and ask, what might this do to autistic individuals? And several studies have now shown that there is some evidence that intranasal oxytocin might enhance social cognitive function in some tasks. So what we've been doing is thinking about, so one of the limitations of the intranasal oxytocin is that, first of all, you have to sniff about 2 teaspoons of liquid, and not very much of it actually gets in. So I think we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg of what can really happen here. So we've been taking a little bit different strategy. What if you sort of think creatively and think, how can we stimulate the brain's own endogenous oxytocin release? So how might you go about doing that? Well, what if you think about oxytocin neurons and identify receptors that are on oxytocin neurons that may have drugs that can target those receptors that you could give that could pass the blood-brain barrier and then maybe bind those receptors and stimulate the brain's endogenous oxytocin release. And this way you can release oxytocin directly into the brain and where the receptors are highly concentrated and maybe have an even more profound effect on social cognition. And of course, all kinds of studies like this have to begin with animal models and drug testing. And we have actually identified one receptor that is highly concentrated on the oxytocin neurons called the melanocortin 4 receptor. And there are drugs out there available that have been developed for other purposes that target that. So we simply ask the question, if you take a vole, and before you place them with another vole, you inject them with this agonist for this receptor that's on oxytocin neurons, will it stimulate a social attachment? And indeed, we found an even more profound effect than we would if we injected oxytocin directly into the brain. So this is time spent with a partner, stranger, you can see in the high dose. They spent almost all of their time with the partner, so they formed a very strong social attachment. So by manipulating the oxytocin system in this way, you can induce social attachments. And the important thing here clinically, I think, is that even if you tested a week later, so immediately after the cohabitation, you separated them, so all the drug is gone, and they haven't been with their partner for a week, then you test them, they still have that partner preference, which means if we think about the pair bond as a learning process, they've learned social information, that social information is retained for a long time. So thinking about that clinically, how might this be used? Well, I don't think that oxytocin or any other drug like this is going to be sort of a drug that you would take that would just make individuals social. But what it does is tune individuals into the social stimuli. And I think that maybe the most appropriate use of this might be to combine it with behavioral therapies, like applied behavioral analysis, where individuals are taught by a therapist social skills and social processes, and it may actually enhance that. And so I think that this is the last bit of my talk, but I just want to make the point that, that I think this illustrates how important it is to understand biological systems in animal models and then be able to think creatively and how to translate that into human applications. And I just wanted to highlight this sort of an effort that we have at Emory that I think is maybe a model for how we should think about proceeding with translational research, which is we have developed a Center for Translational Social Neuroscience, which combines, on one hand, basic neuroscientists like myself that are interested in the basic neurobiology of social behavior, as well as clinicians who are interested in autism and schizophrenia. And we've come together as a group to exchange information and exchange ideas to try to make the progress of translating the animal research into real human clinical applications. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. Our next presenter is Eric Nessler. Eric was formerly the director of the Division of Molecular Psychiatry at Yale, chair of psychiatry at UT Southwestern, and is currently Nash Family Professor and chair of the Department of Neuroscience and director of the Friedman Brain Institute at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Eric actually wrote with Steve Eyman probably the most influential paper on the mechanism by which antidepressants work. He's going to talk about the importance of reward systems with respect to addiction and depression. Please welcome Dr. Eric Nessler.
Well, good morning, everyone. Thanks for having me here. Actually, the paper that Maurizio mentioned, where Steve and I talked about how antidepressants work, our main conclusion was that we didn't know how they worked. But I think that's a good point for today's symposium. It's a great pleasure to be here, and thanks for having me. Over the last several decades, the field of neuroscience has defined discrete regions of brain called brain reward regions. These are areas that were first found in animals, later validated in humans, that regulate an individual's responses to natural rewards in our environment, like food, sex, and social interaction. And in fact, this cartoon is very similar to what Larry Young just showed. That makes sense, and social interaction is a very powerful reward. The focus of these brain reward regions are a series of very small dopamine-containing nerve cell cluster located at the base of the brain in the ventral tegmental area. These are different from the nearby substantia nigra dopamine nerve cells that die in Parkinson's disease. These VTA dopamine cells do not innervate motor regions of brain. Rather, they innervate so-called limbic or emotional circuits in brain that regulate emotional responses. Areas in the temporal lobe, such as amygdala and hippocampus, or certain regions of the frontal part of the brain, or a very small region in the front base part of the brain called the nucleus accumbens, also mentioned by Larry. And in fact, this VTA nucleus accumbens circuit has been extensively well characterized for its role in regulating rewarding responses, studies that have relied heavily on animal models and recently validated in humans, as shown in this slide, which will depict the way these nerve cells function. This comes from a functional or fMRI study from a couple of years ago, focusing on the ventral tegmental area. You could see how small this brain area is at the very base of the brain. What the investigators did was to study the activity of the VTA in response to a natural reward, in this study, money. And what they found is that when an individual was given money unexpectedly, that led to a very large increase in the activity of the VTA. As the individual learned to expect the money at a certain point in time, but didn't receive the money, it caused a huge reduction in the activity of the VTA, and an expected reward showed a moderate response. In this way, you could think of these types of responses to the VTA, an unexpected reward producing a powerful stimulus, expected reward still producing a stimulation, but less so, and an withholding of an expected reward decreasing the activity of the VTA. In fact, aversive stimuli in some cases also decrease the activity of the VTA, powerfully shaping every aspect of our function, minute to minute, day to day, to make, guide every choice that we make in life, essentially. Now, one of the interesting discoveries then is that what drugs of abuse do is to target these reward centers of brain and activate them far more powerfully and persistently than what's seen with natural rewards. This is taken from a study by Brider and colleagues from a number of years ago, also by fMRI, not now focusing on the nucleus accumbens, this target region of the VTA, showing a small but significant stimulation in response to money. Sex, food would do about the same thing. And drugs of abuse produce a much more powerful stimulus. It is now generally felt that the power of these effects of drugs of abuse on the brain's reward pathways, which play such a crucial role in regulating all aspects of our behavior, imbue them with the ability to take over our lives when they act on a vulnerable brain. The idea is that these powerful drug rewards, by being without any connection to purposeful or useful behavior, corrupt the circuitry of the brain, leading to a loss of control over drug use in addicted individuals and other consequences of addiction. And we know that drugs do this in ways that produce very long-lasting changes in the brain, because most addicts are at increased risk for relapse despite decades of abstinence. So whatever drugs are doing, they're doing it powerfully and persistently. One of the real important breakthroughs in neuroscience over the last several decades is that we've now delineated the initial actions by which pretty much all drugs of abuse produce these initial effects on the brain. You've seen probably many cartoons of synapses. Just by way of summary, this shows a nerve ending of one nerve cell coming in close approximation with another nerve cell. Communication is mediated by the release of a chemical substance called a neurotransmitter that acts on receptor molecules. And we now know that all drugs of abuse act at the synapse. Many drugs of abuse, as listed here, mimic the body's own endogenous neurotransmitter substances by activating certain receptors in parts of the brain. Other drugs of abuse, in particular the stimulant drugs like cocaine and amphetamine, target the dopamine pump, which normally turns off the dopamine signal. These drugs act on the pump in a way that increases the duration of the dopamine signal at the synapse. Still other drugs of abuse, like alcohol, act on ion channels, which regulate the electrical activity of nerve cells. Now, all of these drugs of abuse are very different chemically and produce very different initial effects, as you could see, yet they all converge by producing the same functional effects on this VTA nucleus accumbens reward circuit. I am not going to explain the details of this slide, and I don't expect you to appreciate them either, but I wanted to emphasize the impressive degree to which scientists today can explain the effects by which a diverse array of drugs of abuse act differently initially on the ventral tegmental area dopamine nerve cells, or nucleus accumbens nerve cells, or other cells in the circuit to produce the same functional effect, this powerful rewarding stimulation. Now, all of these actions reflect the initial effects of drugs of abuse, and that's not enough to cause addiction. As I mentioned, addiction is seen as a response or adaptation to repeated drug exposure, and for that we need to understand how drugs of abuse, how these initial synaptic actions, drugs of abuse, over time change the brain. And this has caused the field to focus on so-called second and third messengers inside of nerve cells and the long-lasting changes that they induce. To summarize a very complex field, we would suggest that there are three main ways that chronic exposure to drugs of abuse change a vulnerable individual. One, people who are addicted to drugs of abuse show reduced responses to natural rewards. Secondly, and somewhat surprisingly, they also cause people to be sensitized to drugs of abuse and associated cues, things in the environment that have been associated with drug exposure. And overlaid on top of this corruption of the reward circuitry is an impairment in cortical control over these more primitive reward pathways. Now, in the interest of time, I'm just going to tell you about one of perhaps several hundred of adaptations that have been identified over the years that underlie each of these three major types of adaptations, focusing on this reduced response to natural reward. This is one of the best established adaptations, both in animal models and in humans, where over time, drugs of abuse cause a reduction in an individual's responses or sensitivity to natural rewards. This makes sense. It could be seen as a homeostatic response to very powerful drug reward stimuli. This dampens an individual's ability to feel rewarded, meaning that without drug, a person feels unmotivated, depressed, not normal. In fact, the easiest way to feel normal again is to take drug. And our group and others have shown that this effect, this loss of this downregulation impairment of the dopamine reward system is mediated partly by actual physical damage to these VTA dopamine neurons in response to drug exposure. And I'll just show you some examples of those data. This comes from an earlier study looking at the size and shape of individual dopamine nerve cells in the ventral tegmental area of a rat, showing you two examples of cells from a normal animal, and on the right, cells from a rat that has been treated chronically with morphine. In fact, this type of adaptation occurs in rats that have volitionally self-administered heroin to themselves, highlighting the association of this change with the addiction process. The finding of impaired dopamine signals in animal models has also been seen in human systems. For example, studies by Nora Volkoff and her colleagues over the years, this is a study by PET imaging, have shown a loss of dopamine receptors in a receptive region for some of these dopamine cells near the nucleus accumbens called the dorsal striatum or caudate putamen. Note in this study the ability of several drugs of abuse to cause a decrease in this dopamine signal in this part of the brain. Well, we now have a very good idea, because we have an animal model, of the molecular mechanisms underlying this shrinkage of VTA dopamine neurons. What we have shown is that chronic exposure to a drug deprives these dopamine nerve cells of a crucial growth factor called BDNF, or brain-derived neurotrophic factor, specifically in the VTA. The rest of the brain is largely unaffected. This loss of dopamine signaling is responsible for the shrinkage of VTA dopamine neurons and a loss of reward behavior. And in fact, we've been able to show that restoration of BDNF signaling in this one brain area corrects both the decrease in cell size and the impaired reward behavior. And I'll just show you some of those data. This slide shows the size of VTA dopamine nerve cells, shows the ability of knocking out BDNF from these nerve cells to cause a shrinkage in VTA dopamine neurons. I'd like to highlight that although this is a very brief clause, it involves very complex molecular biological tools that have only become available over the last 10 years. The ability to take an animal that's normal throughout development and use genetic tricks to remove a single gene only from a single type of nerve cell in the adult animal. These kind of powerful tools have revolutionized our ability to understand the brain and have, for example, led us to show that this loss of BDNF, specifically in VTA dopamine cells, can cause VTA dopamine neurons to shrink, mimicking the effect of chronic morphine. And note in this case, when we injected BDNF directly into the VTA of a rat, same results occur in a mouse, you can completely reverse these detrimental effects of chronic morphine administration. Now, the major challenge in the field is to translate these types of discoveries from animal models into improved treatments. We know that most addicts today are not fully treated readily by available treatment approaches. The discovery of BDNF and literally hundreds of other signaling cascades that other investigators have identified as being crucial for the addiction process now identifies many additional ways in which we can approach the treatment of addiction, so that all current medication treatments of addiction focus on neurotransmitters and their receptors. These are literally the tip of the iceberg of hundreds of intracellular signaling proteins that could also be targeted. We think this is really one of the crucial times for neuroscience in this regard. If one looks at the physician's desk reference, it's a big book that lists all the medications available for the treatment of all conditions in our bodies. Those medications target perhaps a few hundred of the hundreds of thousands of proteins that we know are expressed in our body. To me, this is a Sputnik moment. To mine these hundreds of thousands of other proteins that we know are there and have been implicated heavily in disease for the development of new treatments. And finally, I think it's very important to emphasize the degree to which studies of brain reward and drug addiction have greatly informed our understanding of other psychiatric conditions, in particular stress-related illnesses like depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. In fact, in animal models and increasingly now in humans by brain imaging, it's been possible to show that many of the same mechanisms, even the same molecules, that impair reward in addiction play analogous roles in these stress-related conditions. This makes sense because one of the cardinal features for most people with depression and many people with PTSD is a loss in the ability to experience normal pleasure, so-called anhedonia. And in fact, several treatments, like those that are targeting BDNF signaling cascades that show efficacy in animal models of drug addiction, show similar efficacy in animal models of depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. So we believe that this research focused on brain reward pathways will have ramifications far beyond treating drug addiction per se to treat many other psychiatric conditions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Eric. Our next presenter is Helen Maber. Helen, who's a neurologist who completed her training at Columbia, was a professor at the University of Toronto, and is currently professor of psychiatry and neurology and the Dorothy Fuqua Chair in Psychiatry, Imaging, and Therapeutics at Emory University School of Medicine. Helen has been really a pioneer in the understanding of the brain circuitry in depression, and it's been really a tremendous force of nature when it comes to developing new treatments for depression that really take advantage of that knowledge through deep brain stimulation. So please welcome Dr. Helen Maber.
First, I just want to thank Dr. Hyman and Congressman Kennedy for inviting me to participate in this. I've got a lot of new ideas for experiments down with lots of collaborators, so I appreciate the opportunity to participate. Everyone's heard a lot over the last number of sessions the word depression. It accounts for the greatest burden in neuropsychiatric disorders. It's comorbid with all the conditions that we'll hear about over these 2 days, whether it's PTSD or addiction, for the neurological disorders, Parkinson's, Huntington's, Alzheimer's disease, post-traumatic stress disorder. But today I want to talk about primary depression. And I want to talk about how, from our advances in neuroscience, how we can harness the work in patients to develop a new treatment. Because I'm talking about a new treatment, it's important that I disclose a few things to you. The work I'll be talking about led to a patent, which has now led to what is a full-scale clinical trial over the course of less than 5 years. I'll be talking about, for the purpose of this, the off-label use of devices, and devices manufactured by two companies. But I want to talk about the idea of how we leverage science, industry, regulatory bodies, academia toward this common goal. I think the first thing that's really important to do, because depression is messy. Depression is hard, as we've heard throughout this, and hard problems need kind of new ways of thinking. But I think it's important to actually not just have the diagram, but to actually appreciate what the experience of being depressed is like, because it is really a bad place. I've never been depressed, but in fact, just listening to what patients go through really is a cause of where our needed work is. And as a neurologist, one can become fairly overwhelmed with the narrative and kind of say, look, this is no place for a neurologist. If you actually just dissect William Styron's words, and you can look at the blue and the red letters. There's a clue to the neurology of this disorder embedded in the painful narrative. It is a virtual paralysis. People are not paralyzed, but they feel as though they are. The brain is slowed down, but that is in context of a very active and distressing state. The act of anguish that goes back to the time of Hippocrates, of really the origin of what this problem may be. So as we kind of struggle with what do we do with this, the good news is that we do have a number of treatments. The problem is the status quo is lousy. And as we've learned from many studies, that we've been harnessed by 50 years of a focus on the monoamines, which have gotten us some tremendous drugs and have provided tremendous healing for many patients. But the problem is about 10% of people don't respond to anything that we've got to give them, that people who have gotten better stop responding to what we have and become resistant over time. And even when we get our biggest guns, electroconvulsive therapy, we only get half the people better, and even then they relapse. So we don't have pathology. We sit and lament the idea, well, it's a clinical heterogeneous disorder. We don't have biomarkers. We don't have genes. You know, we're really in a quandary. And our animal models, as wonderful as they are, and I'm a big fan of animal models, they're lousy. They don't characterize what William Styron defined. They're useful, but importantly, what they don't capture is relapse or resistant. Animal models tell us how the drugs we already have work, and we need something new. So it's in this context that the question is how does a neurologist address this problem? Neurologists go to the brain. The brain is not just a bowl of soup, add a chemical and stir. The brain is chemistry in circuitry. We saw yesterday, I mean, our circuitry, as you will see, is wildly pedestrian. But sometimes not having that level of resolution that we saw yesterday with a connectome, which was pretty dazzling. But the issue is we still need to know what's the illness circuit, what pathways are part in that massive circuit are responsible for why people get better. That will lead us to what changes are necessary, sufficient, and critical, which will give us targets and which will allow us to see what to do in individual patients. So what has facilitated this kind of moonshot idea? It's been the availability of imaging. It's been advances in stereotactic neurosurgery. And as we learned yesterday, this lays a foundation that we already have basic science tools that are going to help us to figure out what we did with items 1 and 2. So again, this does not function in a vacuum. This becomes how people leverage what's already known from other points of view. And for the story of DBS in depression, it's about leveraging what was already done over the previous 10 years in movement disorder. And again, to put it in context, depression is not Parkinson's disease. Parkinson's disease has pathology. You know, it took taking what James Parkinson saw with the loss of the pigment in the nigra for it to be figured out that that was loss of dopamine cells. But by understanding a dopamine abnormality led to an evidence-based treatment for Parkinson's, DOPA, which was great until even DOPA stops working. And it was then understanding, how does DOPA work in the brain? Again, it's not, dopamine has very, very selective targets in the brain, works within circuits, and it took the physiologists working with the anatomists, working with the chemists, to understand how dopamine works within the integrated basal ganglia circuits. And to not belabor it, it was these targets that are circled. Those are targets that before there ever were drugs were places where you could ablate in the brain and alleviate depression symptoms. And then again, it was the cleverness of really co-opting the physiological approach to these targets for the purpose of ablation that led to neurosurgeons using selective high-frequency neuromodulation to actually tune the brain rather than damage the brain and achieve the same effects. And this was the development of the modern era of deep brain stimulation. So how do we approach this? So over the last 25 years, we and many other investigators have tried to actually identify, map out a circuit of depression. And the way we do this is through functional neuroimaging, compare depressed and non-depressed. People start to collect areas of the brain. You start to organize them into some kind of a map. And it's then through how do different treatments actually impact these areas, we start to see that medications work on certain components of the circuit. Cognitive therapy can work on other elements of the circuit. We can see synergy, that everything is not overlapping. But you actually now have a pretty big game board. And the question is where might DBS fit into this? Well, it became very clear that certain areas of the brain were more important than others. An area deep in the brain, in the subcolossal cingulate, a Brodmann area 25, seemed to activate during intense negative mood. It seems to downregulate in response, in terms of response to many treatments, whether they be drugs, TMS, ECT, even VNS. And so our hypothesis was that if you can't talk it down, drug it down, or shock it down, maybe what you really need is to target it at its origin. And if you could modulate it locally, you could affect it and everything it talks to. So what is deep brain stimulation? It's a routine procedure done, it's been done in probably nearly 100,000 patients with Parkinson's. It involves the careful surgical implantation under MRI and physiologic guidance of a small wire to whatever point in the brain you want. It's a small wire. The contacts are about a centimeter long with four potential stimulation points. It's connected once implanted in the brain to a battery pack that you wear implanted totally underneath the skin in the chest. So what patients do we do? Going to try out this kind of slightly out there hypothesis. It's really about patients who have no options. And if you can imagine, this is William James' description of his own depression, which actually was eminently treatable. Imagine being in this state where absolutely nothing has worked and hasn't worked for some time. And those are the patients we approached for our initial study. So this is now kind of old news. It's nearly to the day on the 8th anniversary of the first patient in Toronto. Again, seeing here from the original proof of principle publication, using MRI guidance, kind of having a gross idea of where we're going, implantation of the electrode. And we did this in six very treatment-resistant patients. They were all really disabled. Illness duration about 5 years, failed multiple medications. And over the course of implantation, using parameters developed for Parkinson's disease, giving it a first guess, got four out of the first six patients, not just better, but nearly well. And for an imager, being able to show that the overactivity of area 25 seen prior to treatment was actually blocked, and that areas connected to area 25 were affected, inconsistent with our hypothesis. That work led to an expansion from the original six to 20 patients. This is the second publication that shows the time activity curve of the change in the depression severity scores over time, drops and stays. And what you can see here is a long-term follow-up that just came out last month, that for many of the patients that were followed, if you got better, you stayed better as long as you had continuous stimulation. You need to keep the stimulator on to maintain effect. You will lose effect over about 2 weeks if you turn it off. It is not like a light switch. It does not come back immediately. There were not either early or late developing side effects, which I think is really important. There doesn't seem to be evidence of tachyphylaxis, meaning we don't lose the effect over time or need to change the dose. But I think most importantly for these patients, these are people that were disabled, and we had 65% of them at a year who had jobs or meaningful activity. And of those people who on the numbers that we measured were better, 90% of them had returned to some form of activity of daily life. So we had some unexpected effects in the operating room that actually have helped us to think about this back to the neuroscience. You know, when you think about antidepressants, they take some time to work. So imagine our surprise as we're stimulating the operating room purely for the purpose of making sure nothing bad would happen. To have patients suddenly report a sense of calm, relief, the pain, and whatever the gut feeling is of this, having it kind of regress acutely, followed by interest, talking, being more engaged. The people in the operating room 4 hours already and suddenly kind of interested in what's going on, what they might want to do, not seeing side effects. And it was this acute effect that actually has led to which contact to stimulate, because you could be a millimeter and a half away from each other, get an effect versus not get an effect. And at first we kind of like, oh, you'll work that out later. And now that's become a very important opportunity to not only figure out where to stimulate more precisely, but actually maybe to understand what's the primary process going on. So, you know, here's my most favorite quote from the operating room. And this was really cute. We all laughed. Turned out this guy had five children. To him, the noise, the pain was just like, get out of the room, please. And suddenly turning off that noise and being able to do other things. But these early effects actually heralded a more profound and pronounced change over time. So this was something important to look at. So if we go back to, again, this gets back to the issue of biomarkers and all these diseases. We want everybody to get better. The question is how to use what doesn't happen, the non-responders as well as the responders, to actually understand the science. And if you look at the original PET scans, everybody, responders and non-responders, down-regulated area 25. It was actually projecting out of 25 that became very important. So actually trying to study the pathways impacted by now again going back to imaging, taking advantage of other technologies like the diffusion tensor tractography methods, we can literally go in one patient to look at a contact where we get an effect versus a contact right next to it where we don't get an effect, and start to understand why some people get better and some people don't, and start to piece this puzzle together. So the next steps is industry's doing it. They've taken it. They'll do what was started and move on. The issue, though, is we have refinement to do. They're not going to do that. We have to do that. We need to get responders. We need to figure out the mechanisms. We need the reverse translation studies and the next generation of devices to work from what was leveraging something that was available to actually doing it exactly how we want in the way we want it. And that gets into figuring it out like the tools we saw from optogenetics yesterday. And we need committed collaborations, not just from a bunch of well-meaning psychiatrists and neurologists and neurosurgeons, but engineers, computational modelers. We need collaborative efforts with government and with industry. I just want to finish with this quote from a patient, because again, we can get very caught up in, you know, this is hard. How do you do it? Keeping the patient safe. And actually have to get back to thinking about the patient. It's the patient that got us here. It's a patient that's going to lead us in some ways. This is a patient that made it very clear as to what we were doing. He goes, look, you didn't give me anything. You make me happy. Didn't enhance reward. You actually took something really bad away. That was the system reset, I think. And now, instead of being in this pit where I have no idea where I am, I'm actually up on this ledge. So I actually realize now I can participate in my own recovery. I think the patient is telling us about plasticity and the capacity for plasticity. And this is a patient that now as well got her first job in 14 years. And she said, DBS doesn't make it easy, it just makes it possible. Now my efforts have impact. And I think this is a call to arms for the clinicians, that the neuroscientists have to figure out what we do next, but that we need rehab. And it's not going to be enough for industry to just say, hey, I got approval for this. There's going to need to be a rehab element to this to really understand it. And it's our job to figure out the optimal ways to facilitate this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Helen. I think you You pointed out the important thing that we start with patients, we go back to patients. Ultimately, neuroscience research has to be focused on that, and we're finishing our symposium with an advocate, Linnea Johnson, who has completed recently her BA in English and creative writing. She has published a book called Perfect Chaos that describes her experience of living with being diagnosed with bipolar disorder. She manages and writes for the blog for Bring Change to Mind, and also works with a filmmaker and physician, Dina Raston, and has her own website called www.lineasinda.com. So please welcome Linnea Johnson.
Thank you. Well, my name is Linnea Johnson, and I am a mental health and disability advocate. First, I want to thank Garen and Patrick for being here. This is an amazing and inspiring conference, and it has so much hope for patients and for all of us, I believe. So I grew up as the daughter of a vocational rehabilitation counselor dad who worked with spinal cord and brain injuries, and a special education professor mom who taught about emotional behavior disorders. So I grew up knowing about disabilities and knowing that they were something that to me was normal, something that so many people experienced. I grew up also with a very big interest in the brain and a big interest in psychiatric disorders. I remember at the age of 10 reading the DSM and diagnosing all of my friends and my guinea pig. So I've been interested in this for a very long time. Of course, I didn't know what the future would hold and that this would actually become a very big part of my life. So in high school, I was the overachiever. I was doing everything from music to all the AP classes, clubs, sports, just constantly going from 6 in the morning to 11 at night. And at that point, I started to have pretty large depressions. And at this point, we didn't know if it was simply an overachiever that would go, 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 and then crash, or if it was something that was larger than that. And then at that point, I really thought that I could be better than this and that I could pull myself up by my bootstraps, that I was not working hard enough to make this go away. At this point, I also started to see a counselor for the first time and had saw a psychiatrist for the first time. I was given my first medications, which I promptly flushed down the toilet. Being a 16-year-old that didn't want to take medications and didn't want to have a brain disorder, which was something very real at the time, but for me it was something that I felt they just didn't understand, that I was just a 16-year-old that was going through a hard time. So in the end, I thought that I pulled myself up by my bootstraps and actually just had gotten better for a while, and I went off to college as a music major. Got a scholarship to study classical piano and was just going again full speed, and then started to get some major depressions again. And by my sophomore year, I was so depressed and so suicidally depressed that my boyfriend at the time had to call my parents, who lived in Seattle, and we were in Chicago, and told them that they needed to bring me home because I wasn't safe. From there, I moved home with my parents and again felt that I wasn't good enough to be able to keep myself out of this depression and make myself feel better, and eventually was hospitalized for being so suicidally depressed, and at that point had ECT and had lots of trials of different medications, none of which really could help what was going on. But eventually, with the ECT, I started to feel a little better and started to come out of this depression. From there, it was a long journey where I had several manias and was eventually diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And at that point, I found myself, even though I understood disabilities and understood that they were normal, I found myself saying, not me. I don't have a disability. I'm not crazy. And I was 19 and terrified, and I felt that They were giving me this diagnosis that didn't seem to fit with who I was. I thought that this was a life sentence, that my life would be ruined. And I didn't understand that it was something that I could work through because I didn't connect, I didn't find anyone that was dealing with the same things. I felt very much alone. The only people I knew that had this illness were in the psychiatric department with me. They were homeless or they had drug and alcohol addictions. They were much, much older than me. And I didn't have anyone that was 19, that was a female that I connected to that had bipolar disorder or that had this any kind of depression or illness that they would talk about. So I felt very, very much alone. And I want to thank you all for being here and doing the work that you do, because in the end, it was science that really brought me out of this and brought me into a place of acceptance. Because I think that was the hardest part, was accepting this illness and learning that it actually wasn't my fault. Learning that, in fact, 9.5% of people have a mood disorder. Learning about different advocacy organizations that I could get these statistics from. Learning that it was actually a brain disorder, that something was in my brain, and that it wasn't, in fact, my fault. That was the basis of my acceptance. Of course, this is a constant process of acceptance as you go through numerous other episodes. It's a constant process. So it was initially through science that helped me really come to terms with this, and through science that I began to have the appropriate treatment to help me get to the place where I am today, where I've been stable for a long time. And in the end, I think that what's most important to me and what I hope you can bring away from this is to really think about the human story. You talked earlier about the quotes that were of patients, and I think about all of the stories that were told so far by Senator Cleveland and Congressman Markey and Congressman Kennedy, hearing the personal story, that we are all so connected in this, and that when we go back, it's an individual story that's behind the genes. It's an individual story that's behind all of the tests that are being done. And behind every individual is a family story. And when you get to the families, you can just go out from there. And in the end, we are all connected to this. We are all connected to different brain disorders. And I really hope that that's something that we get out through all of this. And as we make these scientific connections, we remember the family stories and the stories that we each go through and each experience with our own families. So in the end, this is a really short talk, I realize, but I hope that through this strong scientific connection, we can remember the strong human connection and make all of our lives easier, happier, and stronger in the end. Thank you.